Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the apparent retaliation by the United States against North Korea with a cyber attack that has shut down the internet in North Korea, rendering it completely dark and disconnected from the World Wide Web. Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University and the author of Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990, joins us to discuss the latest threats from North Korea and the world's first official cyber war in response to North Korea's cyber attack on the Japanese Sony Corporation's motion picture studios here in Los Angeles. Then we'll discuss the worsening economic outlook for Russia as its economy and currency continues its spiral into recession with no clear sense that the reality of sanctions, falling oil prices, and global isolation are intruding on Russia's new Tsar Vladimir Putin and the coterie of Siloviki, the former KGB cronies turned oligarchs surrounding Putin. Economist Anders Aslund, a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics, who worked as a Swedish diplomat in Moscow, joins us to look into whether those who have looted Russia have a clue how to avert the downward slide of a resource-dependent economy. Then finally, we'll examine the shocking malaise in American politics expressed by the record low turnout of 36% of eligible voters in the last election and assess whether the disgust Americans feel towards Republican and Democratic politicians will lead to the disintegration of our political system as more and more citizens abdicate the democratic process while more and more money pours into politics from well-funded special interests. Thomas Ferguson, a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts and the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, joins us to discuss his new article at Alternet, Americans Are Sick to Death of Both Parties, Why Our Politics is in Worse Shape Than We Thought. And joining us now is Charles Armstrong, a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled simply The Koreas, Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest book is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. Welcome to Background Briefing, Charles Armstrong.
Good to be with you.
And this seems to be a pretty bad day for North Korea, because a few days ago the UN General Assembly voted in favor of referring North Korea to the International Criminal Court. And in spite of efforts by China and Russia to block a debate, the UN Security Council took up the debate today. And U.S. Envoy Samantha Power described North Korea as a living nightmare, where the regime does unspeakable atrocities, including deliberate starvation, forced labor, executions, torture, and political repression. And all this is happening on a day when the North Korean internet goes dark, presumably as a result of a counter cyber attack by the United States.
Well, it is a bad day. Now, the assumption we all make, I think, is that this is a deliberate retaliation and that cyber war has begun. But the U.S. government hasn't claimed responsibility for this, and there is some evidence that I am seeing that suggests that this denial of service or the blackening of the North Korean internet service is not the doing of the U.S. government. So, but somebody is certainly behind this, and North Korea does not have very good internet service, to say the least, but it's completely gone dark, and clearly this is some deliberate action. It has to be kept in mind that the North Korean government is convinced that all of these things, the UN report on human rights, the discussion of the National Assembly, and even the Sony movie The Interview, are part of a single nefarious plot by the U.S. government to bring down the North Korean regime. They take this very seriously, and that was the reason, presumably, they were behind, although they deny that they were behind it, the cyber attacks on Sony.
Well, the U.S. government's State Department spokeswoman said the following in response to reporters' questions about this North Korean internet going dark. We aren't going to discuss publicly operational details about the possible response options or comment on those kinds of reports in any way, except to say that as we implement our responses, some will be seen, some may not be seen. So that's not exactly a denial of that the U.S. might be behind this.
No, but it's not an admission either. So Right. Welcome to the dark world of cyber warfare. Both sides appear to be engaged in this, and neither side will assume responsibility for it. This is, I'm afraid, the way of the future in the conflict, not just between the U.S. and North Korea, but possibly elsewhere in the world as well. It's a very strange world we've entered now.
Well, the North Korean internet, of course, goes through China. So that makes it even more difficult to understand how this is being done. I don't pretend to know how cyber attacks are conducted or thwarted or anything about them, except that there's clearly a massive gap between military capabilities and civilian defenses, which was made clear by Sony's the hack on Sony, and subsequent to that hack, Sony, one of the statements coming from Sony was that no American corporation, or 90% of all American corporations, could not have withstood the attack that Sony did. And they did, after all, extract, I think, 10 times the terabytes of the Library of Congress, and at the same time wipe clean all of Sony's databases.
Well, let's hope we're not in a cyber war with North Korea, because I'm afraid we're much more vulnerable than they are. Precisely because North Korea has so little internal internet service, they aren't subject to the kind of disruptive attacks that we would be if someone did, in fact, hack into essential services. You know, people don't need the internet to get by, for the most part, in day-to-day life in North Korea. We do. So this is truly asymmetrical warfare. I have to say, the title of my book, Tyranny of the Weak, seems more appropriate than ever when it comes to this sort of asymmetrical warfare, in which North Korea actually attacks us at a point, whether it's the government or corporations, where we have much greater vulnerability than they do.
But some of the apologists here in Hollywood, there have been quite a number of people like George Clooney have petitioned the studios to withstand effectively having Kim Jong-un decide what movies get shown in the United States. But the studios didn't back down. I mean, they rolled over and canceled this showing of this film. They may show it later. But the long and the short of it is that here in Hollywood, you can't possibly submit to the idea that just because a country is crazy and does things that no other countries do, that you shouldn't make movies that might upset them. It's the same logic of saying, well, you can't make a movie about the Scientologists because they're so litigious. You know, I mean, one shouldn't have to sort of submit preemptively to censorship, surely.
Oh, I agree. I don't think we should. And I think that freedom of artistic expression is very important and should be valued and protected. But I think that the people who made this movie should have anticipated the kind of very harsh reaction that North Korea would give. You know, their leader is a sacred figure to them. It's more or less the equivalent of having a movie which comedically burns the Koran. I mean, we can do it, and we have the freedom to do that, but you're going to get a lot of Muslims extremely upset. And if you have a living leader of a sovereign country by name getting assassinated in a movie, even if it is a comedy, and even if we don't think it's a big deal, I think the North Koreans will think it's a big deal. This certainly doesn't justify their actions. It certainly doesn't give them license to hack a corporation and reveal sensitive information. And it doesn't mean that we should bow down to their demands. But it's just that there should have been more anticipation that North Korea is a real country, Kim Jong-un is a real person, and this was bound to elicit a very strong reaction.
So what do you think, though, given the volatile nature of this regime? I mean, they have pushed the envelope more than, I think, any other country on the planet. They shelled parts of South Korea. They sunk a warship. They seem to play by their own rules, and it would seem to me that you'd have to be careful ratcheting up your tit for tat with the North Korean regime. You could tip them over the edge, right?
Yes, we do have to be careful, and this is what I'm saying. This is, in fact, an area in which we don't necessarily have a great advantage. You know, we're not going to lose a conventional war with North Korea. The U.S. is, for that matter, South Korea is a far richer and more technologically advanced country than the North. But in this type of cyber exchange, North Korea actually has some interesting advantages, and we have to tread very carefully lest we fall victim, as apparently Sony has done, to North Korean attacks. So I think this is a very complicated situation that we find ourselves in, and it certainly isn't over yet.
Well, but given that North Korea's internet access is routed through China, is there a possibility that China is in any way cooperating with the U.S.? I mean, I've read reports recently of high-level military and foreign ministry people privately expressing their annoyance with the regime, but obviously officially China's not going to repudiate their relationship with this neighbor, right?
Yes, that's right. On the surface, China is a close ally, indeed the only ally of North Korea. But the leadership going up to the top, Xi Jinping, the premier, is quite unhappy with North Korea's actions, particularly under the current leader, Kim Jong-un. And the U.S. has put a great deal of pressure on China to get North Korea to change its behavior and to put pressure on North Korea for such things as human rights and the cyber attacks specifically. So it is certainly possible, and I don't know if we can ever know for sure, that China is cooperating in an attack on North Korea's internet and service, and that would make a lot of sense given the sensitivity of North Korea's internet access to China and the fact that essentially China is the gateway to North Korea's internet.
So, but China has, and all of the neighboring countries and the U.S. for the longest time have tried to, and the U.N. itself, it's under U.N. sanctions, North Korea, because of its nuclear tests. And it seems to me that there's no way in the world that the North Koreans are going to give up their nuclear program.
Well, they've said as much. They said that we are a nuclear armed state and we want to be recognized as such. So we're in quite a dilemma here. Sanctions don't seem to have worked, and it's not clear what could really be done to put more pressure on North Korea other than China cutting off their lifeline. You know, China gives a great deal of food. China supplies most of the energy and the fuel oil to North Korea. If they wanted to, China could really cut all of that off and make North Korea very vulnerable. But the strategic choice for China is that they don't want instability, they don't want a collapse in North Korea, so they're going to keep North Korea viable, and that's the situation we are now and the situation we've been in for years.
So is China's concerned about a collapse of North Korea simply that the U.S. will be on the Yalu River as they were in the Korean War, which provoked the Chinese to enter the Korean War?
That's part of it. They don't want a pro-U.S. Korean regime all the way up onto their border. They don't want U.S. troops on their border. But more generally, they don't want instability. They don't want to be flooded with refugees, and they don't want to have the kind of chaos that a collapsing North Korea might create. This is not necessarily going to be a peaceful and easy transition. They would prefer the status quo, as difficult as it is, to the uncertainty of losing North Korea as a neighbor.
So what do you think then is, we're talking about a country that hasn't collapsed and the predictions of it collapsing have been pretty perennial. It does seem dysfunctional, and even the young leader seems to complain about why things don't work. Do you think they're vulnerable? I imagine at some point or other, if the Security Council tries to refer North Korea to the International Criminal Court, that would be vetoed by either China or Russia. Would that be your expectation?
Oh, yes. I'm quite sure that China would veto any referral of North Korea's regime or leaders to the International Criminal Court. And look, you know, China itself is in an awkward position because they're certainly no North Korea, but they've got human rights issues of their own, and they've been blamed for a lot of cyber attacks on U.S. interests as well. So China is hardly blameless in all of this, and they're not fond of North Korea. There's not a lot of love lost, but they're deciding that it's in their own interest to not push North Korea too hard, lest they become vulnerable to criticism acts that will affect their interests.
But they do seem to be worried, the North Koreans, about this. I spoke with Ambassador Donald Gregg some time back, and he'd just been to North Korea, and they had brought up this movie to him, and he had tried to advise them not to overreact to the movie, the interview, because that would only help publicize the movie. Obviously, they didn't take his advice, but he said they were extremely concerned about this UN referral to the International Criminal Court. And since then, of course, it's passed 170 to 20 at the General Assembly, and it's now being discussed before the Security Council.
Yes, the North Koreans are very concerned about this. They're concerned about the repercussions that it may have on their ability to deal, even with the limited way they are now, with the global economy, with the international community, and that eventually China might feel pressure as a permanent member of the Security Council and as a major player in the world to cut them loose. I don't see that happening in any near-time scenario, but it is conceivable, and the North Koreans feel very vulnerable at this moment. I mean, that's one reason they're lashing out at this movie, which in itself is not an enormous issue, but it's wrapped up in these other concerns and pressures about human rights, about nuclear weapons, and all of these things that, as I said, the North Koreans feel are part of a big conspiracy led by the U.S. to bring them down.
So it's not as if they're playing their cards badly, which would seem to be on the surface. If you're being under scrutiny by the United Nations, you don't want to provoke things by hacking Sony and blowing that up into a big international news story. At the same time, the UN is discussing referring to the International Criminal Court. So your explanation for the North Koreans, you know, being totally, you know, out to lunch in terms of public relations is that they believe that this is an orchestrated attack in the first place. So is that why they're blind? They're blinded by their own. Because my understanding is that they also think that Abe, the Japanese leader, is behind Sony making the movie in the first place, the interview.
Yes, well, one shouldn't overestimate the paranoia. Even paranoids have enemies, of course, and there are certainly people very critical attacking the North Korean regime, and that sort of feeds into this cycle. But the fact that Sony is ultimately a Japanese corporation and the North Koreans probably hate Japan even more than the U.S., that plays into this too. And I would imagine, it appears, that the North Koreans thought they could get away with this attack, that it couldn't be traced back to them, and that this could be attributed to some sympathetic party elsewhere. So we shouldn't overthink how well they thought this through and realize what the repercussions would be. However, they've caught themselves into this situation, which is going to be extremely difficult to get out of.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Charles Armstrong.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Charles Armstrong, who's a professor of history and the director of the Center for Korean Research at Columbia University. His books include The North Korean Revolution, 1945 to 1950, A History of the Peninsula, titled Korean Society, Civil Society, Democracy, and the State. And his latest is Tyranny of the Weak, North Korea and the World, 1950 to 1990. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the Russian economy is in crisis. And all your pump of energy. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots. We are the robots.
From Russia with love, I fly to you, much wiser since my goodbye to you.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Anders Aslan, who is a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, and served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine. And he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy and Democracy. Welcome to Background Briefing, Anders Aslan.
Thank you very much. Good to be here again.
It's good to talk to you again, Anders. And it seems to me that, let me ask you, do you think that Vladimir Putin has a handle on what's happening to his economy? And, he's surrounded by these sycophants and the former KGB cronies turned oligarchs, the Siloviki. And you get the impression from his big 3-hour-long annual press conference just a couple of days ago that maybe he's just trying to be reassuring to the Russian people, but a lot of analysts thought that he just doesn't get it. He doesn't recognize that his economy is in trouble.
Well, the first thing, Ian, it is that you have to recognize that it's a crisis. And President Putin insisted on not using the word crisis about Russia, about Ukraine, fine, Europe, of course, but about Russia, he just called it the current situation. And as long as you are in denial, you can't do anything about it. And the second thing was that he did not offer any policy advice at all. He suggested that the Russian economy would inevitably come back, within at the longest 2 years, because the international economy would come back. But this is after he has blamed the external forces for having brought down the Russian economy. So why should the bad forces help the Russian economy? It's not very clear.
But when his finance minister, Kudrin, warns of a full-fledged crisis, is that resonating? I mean, we know that the Russian people are in a propaganda bubble. They don't get, I don't even know what news they're getting about the current economic status. There seems to be a bit of a run on the banks, and there is an attempt. In fact, one bank just collapsed, the Trust Bank, whose publicist, by the way, is the movie star Bruce Willis. He does their commercials saying, when I need money, I just take it, Well, now the Russian Central Bank has had to bail out this bank. But do you think the fact that the former finance minister is warning there's a crisis, is that getting any coverage in the Russian press?
Not really. You see, his interview, Alexei Kudrin's interview, is an old friend of mine. He had this interview published in Vedomosti, which is co-owned by Financial Times and the Wall Street Journal, which is by far the best financial economic newspaper in Russia. But it will have to be sold because foreigners are no longer allowed to own media assets next year in Russia. So this just shows how tight the situation is getting. And they have a circulation of about 100,000. It's an excellent quality newspaper, but that is the last outpost of reason. And what Alexei Kudrin said today was essentially, if the oil price next year will be $80 per barrel, then the Russian economy will fall by 2% or more, and if the oil price is $60 per barrel, then it will fall by 4% or more. And I would rather say that we are in a situation where we should expect 8 to 10% decline in GDP, because this is a real crisis. So Alexei Kudrin put it correctly, but a bit too softly.
So if the and the projections are, I believe, that oil prices will go down and will stay low for some time, and if there is this and there's still talk on the part of the EU and the US to increase sanctions because of Russia's behavior in Ukraine, do you think that that I mean, there was some reports that there was potential runs on the banks. People were rushing to the stores to buy things, and they, you know, every luxury good and every television set's just about gone off the shelves. So people clearly in the narod, you know, amongst the Russian people, they know that there's something wrong with the ruble, don't they? You can't hide these macroeconomic trends from everybody, can you?
Indeed, the Russian people are astute when it comes to understanding a financial crisis. And if we take it simply, the oil price has now fallen by almost 50%. The ruble normally moves with the oil price, so it has fallen almost 50% in relation to the dollar. Today it was a temporary a rise, but I think that is only temporary. So it was only down by 40% since June, but it will soon be 50% or more. And that means that import prices will be twice as much as before. So therefore, the Russians are now sensibly running to buy all imported electronics, also a bit of cars, and a bit of clothes before they realize that the prices will rise. So a lot of foreign shops have simply closed now because they don't know what prices to charge. They know that everything will cost them twice as much when they import it anew in ruble terms.
So when Angela Merkel, the German chancellor, suggests that perhaps Putin may not be in touch with reality, and you start hearing these kind of comments that he was never a particularly talented individual in the KGB. He surrounded himself with cronies. They've been looting the place since he came into power, and they've gone into overdrive since he claimed the presidency for the third time. It seems that could you make a case, as bad as it is, that you have this peculiar new hybrid in geopolitics where you have national security and organized crime merging, the mafia and nuclear weapons? That's bad enough in itself. But on top of that, is it possible that you have a kind of delusional leader who's trapped because he is a criminal, and criminals, you know, they are afraid because they know eventually their crimes are going to catch up with them.
Indeed, I think that this is very much the situation as you describe it. And Karen DeWish, an American professor of political science at Miami University in Ohio, has just come out with a wonderful book, Putin's
Kleptocracy,
which describes exactly this. And in specifically, what she drives as a thesis, that is that it was not that the Russian reformers failed. It was that they faced a stronger force of a combination of the secret policemen and organized criminals, and they have now taken over. I met Putin in the early 1990s in St. Petersburg, and I must say that from our first meetings, I don't remember him. I remember Kudrin, whom you just mentioned, and I remembered mayor of St. Petersburg, then Anatoly Sobchak, who was the patron of Putin. But Putin was in the background, didn't say anything, made a new impression. He was one of his quiet administrators. But he has turned out to be very skillful in building up his personal networks. And now it is his people who rule. So he has been very skillful in power as an improviser and a tactician, but economics is what he doesn't know anything about, and that's the big problem for Russia today.
Well, but does he know geopolitics and the military? Do you think his the Crimean incursion was well thought out? And more to the point, what's he doing trying to provoke an incident with NATO by flying over NATO bases, almost colliding with Swedish airliners, sending submarines into Swedish waters? That doesn't make any sense. If you don't want to drive Sweden into NATO, do you?
No, and indeed he's doing that. For the first time ever, there is a majority in Sweden for joining NATO. And the other day, 2 days ago, the Prime Minister of Finland, Alexander Stubb, who's a center politician, he said that the next government in Finland should ask for membership of NATO. So his foreign policy makes very little sense. I agree with you on that. But he has really reinforced his hold on Russian power in a ruthless and unpleasant fashion. But that's the real scare.
But how much do you think international opinion, as the Constitution says, the good opinion of mankind? Do you think he, for example, I heard that when he was at the G20 summit in Brisbane, Australia recently, first of all, he went to China thinking he was going to make a big deal with Chinese, and then they wanted to renegotiate these deals because of the collapsing ruble. And then the Chinese leader turns around and makes a huge deal with Obama. And then he goes down to Australia, and apparently everybody there just berated him. And he left early. So does that work, do you think, when he realizes how isolated he is from the rest of the world?
No, but what the Russians say is that he's like a rat who has been cornered, and such a rat is not just lying down dying, but fighting as he can. And the real scare is that Russia has nuclear arms. It is, after all, the second main nuclear power after the United States, and the economy is not there. The Russian economy now is 2 to 3% of global GDP, and then you don't behave like this. So President Putin is materially completely overplaying his hand. At the other hand, he's playing while others are standing back. And then you can dare to do a lot. There's a real danger of a major tragedy now, not trying to predict what the tragedy could be. But this is a very dangerous situation.
So in this dangerous situation, what would your advice be to Obama and other Western and European leaders? Do you, there's been a lot of criticism that about the eastward expansion of NATO, that has done nothing to improve the security of Europe or Russia, and that was unnecessary. So is there a strategy of showing your soft underbelly? And furthermore, what would be the point if the Russian people don't know it? You know, if they're told one thing and you do another, I don't know how you navigate between, Putin and the Russian people. I guess you can't drive a wedge between the two, can you?
It's difficult to do, and if a wedge comes, it will be because the economy will do very poorly indeed. And at a certain stage, the Russian people have to think for themselves, does this make sense? Here, the president says that everything is wonderful and we are suffering so badly. This is where, unfortunately, we will eventually come. But meantime, if you look up on NATO, the three small Baltic countries, Estonia, Latvia, and Lithuania, feel much safer because they are members of NATO. The problem is Ukraine, Georgia, and Moldova that want to come closer to the European Union, but they are not members of NATO. Therefore, they can be subject to attack. So far, NATO has proven to be a stabilizing factor. It's not necessary that it will be in the future. Will NATO really react if little green men, that is unmarked Russian special forces, pop up in eastern Latvia, where 40% of the population are Russian, ethnically Russian, and where the population is quite poor, and there are very few people living there. These are the worrisome situation where NATO will have to prove itself.
But presumably, Putin's popularity, which is still around 80%, I understand, a lot of it rests upon a connection with the Russian people that do feel a kind of a sense of national humiliation, which he stokes. And he keeps telling them, as he did in this press conference a few days ago, that all of their troubles are because of the West is out to destroy Russia. Again, you get to this, how do you prick that bubble? I don't know.
Yeah, but if you take his annual address that he did 2 weeks earlier on the 4th of December, it was gravely quiet, and the audience of 1,000 or 2,000 people in the Kremlin looked at him. Is he sick? Is it really like this? While if you compared on the 18th of March in the same hall, the Georgian Hall in the Kremlin, people were cheering and perfectly happy that Russia was annexing Crimea. So there is a sense of very severe rethinking. Should we really be here in the elite? And people now seem positively frightened, as we can see from these empty, admittedly electronic stores rather than grocery stores all around Russia right now.
And that's bound to get worse, right? That food supplies, imports are just going to dry up, at least we taper off, right?
Yeah, and the irony is that there's a shortage of bovine that Russians really love to eat. They make the blini out of bovine, and now it's very difficult to find it. The prices have gone up by 30% because of the massive demand.
So just in closing, Anders Aslan, what's Obama to do under these circumstances? I understand that he's had a fairly good relationship with Putin and talks to him a lot on the phone. Is there anything that can be done in terms of Obama's leadership?
Well, I think that the relationship between the two of them is really quite bad. Mm-hmm. It's a relationship of mutual contempt. Putin thinks that Obama is a person who's not a real man. You know, he doesn't even go out hunting tigers.
Right.
And President Obama thinks that Putin is really a man of yesterday, who hasn't realized how the world has moved on, publicly says that he doesn't use the internet, etc. So it's really, President Obama feels that Putin belongs to the 19th century, and President Obama feels very much as he's in the 21st century. And by happenstance, it has happened that these financial sanctions from July last year have turned out to be much more effective than anybody really thought on either side, so that Russia now doesn't get any finance from anybody apart from a little bit from the Chinese state, and therefore the Russian economy is just crumbling. So President Obama can rightly say, I manage in my policy to keep the U.S. and Europe together. We didn't need to use more. And that looks right now as if it were right. But if we see another military attack in by Russia in Ukraine, then we would say that it's wrong.
Well, but in the meantime, of course, Putin can always blame the economic woes of Russia on the sanctions, just as Castro has done for 50-something years up until a few days ago.
Indeed, he does so, and this is very much appreciated by the Russian population. The ordinary Russians find it difficult to understand why the West is so mean to them, while any Westerner would say, sorry, Russia has just violated half a dozen of major international ratified treaties on national integrity and sovereignty, and that you can't touch international borders. And the Russians don't know it because the propaganda in Russia is so intense.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us, Anders Aslan.
Thank Thank you very much. It's always Ian.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Anders Aslan, who's a senior fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics and co-chairman of the Board of Trustees of the Kiev School of Economics. He worked as a Swedish diplomat in Kuwait, Poland, Geneva, and Moscow, served as an economic advisor to the governments of Russia, Kyrgyzstan, and Ukraine, and he's the author of How Ukraine Became a Market Economy. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about how Americans are sick to death of both parties and why our politics is in a worse shape than we thought. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's a member of the advisory board of George Soros' Institute for New Economic Thinking and a contributing editor to The Nation. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory of Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and has an article at Alternet, Americans Are Sick to Death of Both Parties, Why Our Politics is in Worse Shape Than We Thought. Welcome to Background Briefing, Thomas Ferguson.
Hi there.
And Tom, it seems that you've assessed this shocking malaise in American politics in the wake of this record low turnout in the last election, which could be according to your article, as low as 36% of eligible voters.
Yeah, so, for sure. Now, one small correction, though, Ian. The turnout's not record low, except over, you know, a particular time interval. I mean, the thing we sort of concentrated on there that really is stunning, if you measure, it's not the only way to do it, but it's, I think, very useful when you got 200 years of data here, is to just sort of look at the off-year turnout election, the turnout in the off-year election, the one we just had from the previous presidential election. That is the second largest drop in American history. That's an absolute shocker. But there have been some pretty low turnouts before. Start with 1942, for example, which was very low. And indeed, there'll be a few years in the 1920s that probably are even lower. But this is a remarkably low turnout election. You know, waiving some details I'm sure we're going to discuss, like a few places where turnout went up. But the thing that attracted our attention was not just the overall level of turnout, which was indeed a substantial fall from either the previous off-year election, that was 210, or the previous presidential election. But the depths to which turnout fell in many states. I mean, in New York, you're looking at turnout levels that are back to the 1790s. In New Jersey, to the 1820s. Now, these are all periods in which, you know, property suffrage laws were just either on the books or just coming off. So that, like in New York, in the 1790s, two-fifths of the population is debarred from voting, who are mm-hmm. males. The females were, of course, all debarred from voting. They were debarred from voting by property suffrage. But, you know, we're back to that overall level of turnout in New York. In Delaware, same story, roughly. 1790s elections were sometimes higher turnout. When you go west, it's a pretty amazing story, which is in California, in Nevada, in Utah, you're looking at the lowest turnouts for House elections in the histories of the state since they joined the Union. I mean, it's an amazing collapse, as it were. That's why I would be careful. I would not be comfortable by saying it's just a record low turnout without it's like pointing out what dimensions are we talking about here.
Right,
we've had lower turnout.
Right, you have, but you've qualified it extensively, and it's yep. It's certainly for since women were able to vote and people weren't voting only voting based upon the property they had. It certainly seems like a record low turnout. But I think that what you're saying most of all, Tom, is that the reason that more and more people are turned off by politics and disgusted with both the Democrats and the Republicans is that we have two trends going in opposite directions. Fewer and fewer, more and more Americans are abdicating the democratic process, while more and more money is pouring in by the special interests who are essentially buying our politics. So fewer people are voting, but more money's coming into the process.
Well, yes, waiving again the question, you know, we won't know for a while whether this year set a record for the most money in an off-year election or not. We're obviously very close to it, but while you got some folks already announcing one way or the other, either it is or it isn't, they don't know, and we won't until you can get the Federal Election Commission data, add it to the IRS data where the independent expenditures, the so-called 527s, come in. And but we're obviously, yeah, but your basic point is absolutely right, which is that you're looking at just a ton of money, an overwhelming deluge there. And that's driving all the parties, both the Democrats and the Republicans. You know, and here I would want to emphasize, no matter how often the New York Times or anybody else claims that, you know, in the New York Times Sunday Magazine, they had a piece about how, you know, most donations are small. Well, you could technically save that if you went for just counted donations. If you count money, the claims are ridiculous. My colleague Paul Jorgensen and Ji Chen and I have added all this stuff up for 2012, there's no question at all that the Democratic Party is hugely dependent on donations from, put simply, the 1%. And it's almost as high as the Republicans in that election, not quite. This is turning people off because basically the money drives the policies they're offered. The article that you're referring to, this thing that's in Alternet now, is co-authored with Walter Dean Burnham, who's probably the greatest American voting expert, maybe who's ever lived, certainly the greatest living one. We look there at, for example, just if you look at the surveys of the people who did vote, you see the usual result, which is that the lower income parts of the population are hugely Democratic. That holds true basically from election to election. You know, forget all the talk about the Reagan Democrats and everything else. That's just basically, it varies, but it's a solid fact. And then that drops off very fast as you go up the income level, that the percentage for the Democrats, till you reach the very top level where it's there's kind of a hiccup there. Otherwise, the rule is as your income goes up, you're much more likely to vote Republican. It's pretty clear what you saw, I think, in 2014, although there were even people trying to tell you that the results didn't depend on who turned out or not. I think that's absurd. It's obvious that huge numbers of lower income people simply did not turn out. And why is not that difficult to fathom? You know, we've had 6 years of a Democratic president and some years in which, you know, the Democrats control either one or both houses of Congress. And, you know, while all the people, all the sort of the media talk about how great the economy is coming back, it's not coming back for most folks. I mean, in July of 2014, the average income of Americans was 6% below where it was in 2008. And, you know, the great bulk of the income, the new income that's come in, that's been generated since 2009 in the slow recovery, has gone to the 1%. It's crazy. And I don't think there's much of a mystery about why, therefore, big chunks of the population are turning off instead of turning out.
So, Tom Ferguson, looking at the post-electoral map, just the colors red and blue, where you have the blue, all the blue votes are concentrated in the cities across the country, yep, and all the red votes are in the urban areas. And my sense for just looking at that map is that the Republicans are going to control the Congress for the longest time and probably the Senate, and that the only branch that the Democrats even have a chance of getting is the presidency, because in those concentrated little blue pockets in urban areas, you have Democrats running against Democrats.
Well, I actually don't think that's true. First of all, for one house, that's the Senate, right?
That's statewide.
This is really important, though, because this, too many folks are making too much of this business of concentration. It's a factor, but it doesn't drive the process. Mm-hmm. And I think there's no way you can explain big changes by it there. And the other side of it is that because of the way 210 went, which was a Republican landslide, those Senate seats will be up for grabs in 2016. So you're going to see a huge number of Republicans running for re-election, much more than the Democrats. In that sense, I think it's quite possible that the narrow Senate lead the Republicans have could be completely erased without a whole lot of trouble. I mean, you might well see the Democrats win that back. But, you know, if they're going to do this, they got to get people to turn out. It is not clear that they can do this. There are speculations, you know, it's a guess here, is that, you know, the economic situation in the U.S. is such that it may just be impossible for a party that's dominated by, well, a chunk of the 1%, but has a sort of legacy commitment to poorer folks. It may just be impossible for those folks to come up with much of anything that's very attractive. And, you know, we'll all find out if this is true, but I think that's the structural problem. You know, if the recovery were to slowly continue, it's obvious the Hillary Clinton strategists are basically planning to run the usual type of Democratic campaign where you talk past most economic issues and try to sort of appeal to specific voting blocks, much smaller there, than sort of talking about really serious, broad economic issues that affect everybody in every race and gender. And, you know, that may well be a losing strategy. What you may see there in that situation is, you know, that type of campaign tends to leave turnout overweighted with wealthy people. And, you know, when most of those get into the polling place, they'd rather have the real Republican instead of Republican light, right, which is where you get from the Democratic side. I mean, that's clear. I mean, right, that's, I think, for the last 6 or 8 years, since really 2006, American politics has been musical chairs, in, out, out, in. You know, but for the fact that the Republicans nominated like a caricature of Richie Rich, as it were, you know, Mitt Romney, who proceeded to openly dump on 47% of the population. If they hadn't done that, it might well be the case that Obama would have been in the position of a lot of Americans, having lost his job and his house in 2012. Mm-hmm. But, you know, otherwise, this in-out-out-in cycle is pretty powerful. What happens in these situations is there's a tendency to move toward both extremes. But, in the American system, it's hard to believe a move further left will get anything like a reasonable hearing in either the media or anything else. So, I'm somewhat skeptical of where the Democrats have left themselves. I think they've been too clever by a half.
Well, clearly they have a problem if they get their money from the same people that the Republicans do, yet they get their votes from working people. they either have to lie or they have to come up with some magic. And I just was noticing in this amazing cave-in in the last in that omnibus bill where Citibank, Jamie Dimon got some Republican congressman. They dictated the rider. Literally, now, put it in. But the point I wanted to make, Tom, is that when I looked into the money that Citibank had given to the Congress and congressmen, there was more money actually given to Democrats than Republicans.
Yes, well, that's a point, you know, I've made actually similar points before. That bill was pretty interesting, not just because it allowed the banks to move their, you know, very risky derivatives back into the insured part of the bank. In other words, the ones insured by basically, in the end, the taxpayers. It's the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation. That was weird. But at the same time, you know, they tossed out public support for union pensions and multi-employer plans. I mean, it was like they were extending insurance to big banks while cutting it for ordinary people. And then, of course, in another provision of the same bill, they proceeded to massively up from, like, depending on how you want to count it, from either 30 or so, 60,000 a year or two, as much as maybe 1.5 million on the limits on individual giving to the political parties under with a lot of fine print. And, I mean, in effect, what they did is they opened the bag, then they gave the banks what they wanted, and they shafted the ordinary American. It's just an absolutely amazing trifecta.
Right, but the point is, Tom, is that this was when the Democrats controlled the Senate. Now they don't control either house, and that means the Republicans can do even more than they just did in this
So they needed Democratic votes to put that across.
But they don't need them anymore, and they, you know, they'll be worse to come, surely, won't they?
I would think that the congressional, you know, I expect to see a lot of presidential and congressional headbutting in the next 2 years. I mean, I think that's correct. You know, whether the White House, I mean, the problem was that the White House was plumping for that bill to go through. They were not opposing it.
Right, but I think that, but do you agree that, just in closing, that this happened when there was still some Democratic influence, when the Republicans control both houses, the kind of legislation they want will be even worse for the American people. It's pretty clear.
For sure. Yeah. If they can pass it. Let's see if they can ask to survive a veto. And in the Senate, they have a problem. They're short of 60 votes, too, which has become the de facto supermajority you've got to have.
We've run out of time, but I really appreciate the conversation. Thanks for joining us, Tom.
Yep. Well, happy holidays.
Happy holidays to you, too. Again, I've been speaking with Thomas Ferguson, who's a professor of political science at the University of Massachusetts in Boston. He's the author of Golden Rule, The Investment Theory, Part Competition and the Logic of Money-Driven Political Systems, and has an article, Alternate Americans Are Sick to Death of Both Parties, Why Our Politics Is in Worse Shape Than We Thought. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can scroll down on the right-hand side to subscribe to iTunes podcasts. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.